Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorien. Well, there have been clashes over the last few months between far-right groups and moderates and progressives and Antifa groups in Portland, Oregon, and we're going to talk about that on the first part of today's program. Before we do, thanks to you, if you made a contribution during the two-day drive yesterday, we raised more than $62,000. It was a tremendous show of support. Thank you for your contribution, if you made one, and you can always make a contribution at WMNF.org. Well, the summer of 2020 has seen the city of Portland, Oregon, become a symbol and a venue for the further dramatic polarization of the U.S. More than 100 nights of intense protests against police violence by left-wing activists have led to further police violence in response and to President Trump declaring the city of Portland a beehive of terrorists and anarchist jurisdiction. A great deal of reporting has been dedicated to the city's leftist protesters. Less attention has been focused on those who perceive the protesters as their enemies. That's a network of patriot militias and extremist groups who have in recent weeks been staging violent confrontations in Portland's downtown streets. I spoke earlier with a reporter who works for an investigative website called Bellingcat.com. He is Robert Evans. He's covered conflicts around the world. And Robert, for the last few months, has been covering the conflicts in Portland, Oregon. And I spoke to him about what's happening there. Robert Evans, thanks for coming on WMNF. First of all, let me ask you about Portland in this past weekend. Did anything happen of major significance in Portland this past weekend?
There was a small rally yesterday. It was a pro-Second Amendment demonstration at the site where a member of Patriot Prayer, which is kind of a local right-wing street movement, was shot during an altercation several weeks back. So there was a rally yesterday. I think about 20 or so people showed up for the pro-Second Amendment side, a decent number of them open carrying. There was a counter-protest from left-wing protesters. It was fairly uneventful. There were a couple of deployments of mace and some hucked water bottles, but nobody got really hurt. Nothing really very significant happened. It was kind of definitely sort of a low ebb and a return to kind of the normal sort of dueling demonstrations that Portland had over the last couple of years, as opposed to the hyper-violent ones, like the one that we had on the 22nd of August, which was a real nightmare in terms of like the amount of force that was went out between both sides.
Are the protests continuing outside the federal building in Portland?
Not on a regular basis. There are protests still continuing. So the protests were starting with the beginning sort of George Floyd's death and the start of protests nationwide. Portland protested every night for more than 100 nights. And then the entire state of Oregon sort of caught on fire. And that kind of, you know, the protesters suspended protests and set up instead a bunch of mutual aid coalitions to, like, provide supplies to people who'd lost their homes and people who were sort of having to evacuate. So basically everybody turned out to help the community during that period, and the protests were paused. And the fires are gone now, but things have kind of continued at a lower ebb. There have been protests, but not every night. People are being a little bit more, I would say, cautious about like when and how they do it, as opposed to kind of feeling like they have to protest every single night in order to keep the streak alive, which was sort of something we were seeing for a while. So things have been on a bit of a lower ebb. But you know, when protests turn out, they're still getting very good numbers. It's not at all uncommon for 500 to 1,000 people to show up for a march.
Yeah, it's pretty big. If I were to use the TV ads by Republicans as a way to gauge how bad things are in Portland, your city's on fire, and I wouldn't want to set foot in it just watching the ads from the Republicans on TV.
If you were to set foot in Portland right now, unless you went out of your way to come across a demonstration or happen to be located next to one of the pieces of police property where they sometimes occur, the only signs you would see that anything's been going on is perhaps some graffiti. The protests in Portland, we had one night that was a real, what I would describe as like a real riot, where just a bunch of people are breaking into businesses and stuff. And that was back on the 29th of May. And since then, looting's been very rare that a business has been broken into, and virtually all protest activity has been focused on police buildings and infrastructure. So, building, the various police precincts, the ICE building, the federal courthouse, the Justice Center, which is our local police headquarters. And those are, you know, individual buildings within a fairly large, sprawling city. The vast majority of Portlanders have seen no signs of anything happening other than, you know, graffiti. And there have been a number of, like, protests that didn't march on police property, right? People have gathered in parks and stuff with Black Lives Matter signs. That happens pretty regularly. But no, the city is not burning. City infrastructure has not been harmed. The majority of businesses outside of, you know, the ones that are not able to do what they do because of COVID remain, you know, open and functioning. Like where I live, the part of town I live, there have been no protests, and you wouldn't know that, like, Portland has become the center of a great deal of national discussion over political violence because it's perfectly quiet out here.
All right, so if I wanted to go to Powell's Books, or if I wanted to go to one of the Asian restaurants along the train line in downtown, or if I wanted to go to the art museum, no trouble. I mean, I could just get around everywhere and do everything I want to do as a tourist in Portland.
Yeah, with the exception of the fact that we're in a pandemic and a number of those places are not, you know, functioning at their normal capacity as a result of state rules about the pandemic. But yeah, you wouldn't run into any issues as a result of the protest. The protests are not going after art museums or Asian restaurants or anything like that. Powell's Books. In fact, I can remember during the big riot night, there was a moment where someone was attempting, like, going up to the Powell's Books as if he was going to break the window, and other people in the crowd were like, no, no, not that one. Go after the banks and the Gucci stores. Don't hurt the bookstore. Which, you know, you can have whatever opinion about you want, but Powell's, yeah, I think, is more or less okay, outside of the fact that it's, you can't really shop inside it the way you used to because there's a plague.
Yeah. Our guest is Robert Evans. He writes for Bellingcat.com, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So I called you up because you wrote this fascinating article a few weeks ago, headlined Patriot Coalition, Leaked Messages Show Far-Right Groups Plan for Portland Violence. And then you go on to say that Bellingcat, your publication, has acquired several months of chat logs from the Patriot Coalition of Oregon, a network of pro-Trump, pro-police activists. These chat logs were provided by an infiltrator affiliated with the anti-fascist collective, the Eugene Antifa. What did you find out when you got inside the chat logs of the Patriot Coalition?
I mean, a tremendous amount of very disturbing things. There was a lot of talk among members of doing night raids, of going out and abducting activists during protests at the night, during the night. There was even talk about targeted assassinations, both of people within sort of the left-wing protest community and within sort of Oregon politics. So there were discussions of, you know, potentially bringing harm to the governor or to the mayor of Portland. There was a lot of talk about preparing for a gunfight with left-wing protesters, as if there was going to be an opportunity to shoot it out in the streets. And there was even some talk about sort of wanting that and hoping that that would happen. And there was a lot of discussion about what kind of illegal weapons, you know, activists could get away with bringing because they felt that the police would not stop them from using illegal weapons like batons and stuff against left-wing activists, whereas, you know, they thought the police would come down on anti-fascists more strongly. And it was very disturbing. I would actually say it kind of had it felt reading through this, and, you know, I've reported on a number of actual war zones. It felt reading through this like a proto-insurgent movement, right? Like they hadn't taken that step, obviously, but they were talking about those sort of things. So it was very unsettling. And when we reported on it, it was taken very seriously by law enforcement at a number of levels and by the state government. Our governor declared a state of emergency before the protest, that preparing for this big Proud Boy rally on the 26th, because this group, Patriot Coalition, was pretty closely tied to the Proud Boys. They had a lot of communications with them. And there, as a result, kind of that rally, number one, the governor threatened to use, Oregon has anti-paramilitary laws. So in the state of Oregon, particularly if you travel to Oregon from elsewhere, having trained with a group of people to do violence, it's a serious crime. And it is also in Florida, as a matter of fact. And in fact, Florida's anti-paramilitary laws are somewhat stricter than Oregon's. So the governor's kind of made a threat that, hey, if people come into Oregon to do violence here, they will be very, very harshly penalized. And that Proud Boy rally was kind of ringed in by police. Of Proud Boys were criminally cited for, and other attendees of the rally were criminally cited for possession of firearms that were not legal for them to be carrying in the way they were carrying them, and possession of other weapons. A lot of people had paintball guns loaded up with rubber-coated metal balls, which they were shooting during that big street fight on the 26th, just kind of blindly into crowds of protesters. There's a number of very large lawsuits, including like a $1.2 million lawsuit against the Proud Boys right now from that rally on the 22nd. So, Patriot Coalition, it was sort of a catch-all organization for folks that weren't affiliated with Proud Boys or Patriot Prayer, but were very closely tied with them and wanted to take action in the street against them, and felt that as a result of how intense the protests had gotten, or at least their perception of how intense the protests had gotten, a much higher level of violence was from them in order to crush the protest. Yeah, in a nutshell, kind of what was going on.
I found it interesting, too, though, some of the discussion in those chat logs was if you were to freeze paintballs, they could become lethal or cause a lot of damage. So you could bring the paintball gun in, and the cops would think, oh, it's just a paintball. But if you said that they actually used metal bearings in the
rubber-coated metal. That's one of the ones they talked about. And yeah, they froze paintballs and they shot them at people. I know people who were hit in the face and pretty badly hurt. The rally on the 22nd. So what happened on August 22nd was a large group of Proud Boys with kind of members of different militia organizations and groups like Patriot Prayer all showed up downtown, 300 or so of them, for a Back the Blue rally. This came the 2 weekends prior to the 22nd. There had also been right-wing rallies in the same location in front of the Justice Center downtown, and both of them had involved gunfire. The week before it had involved gunfire, and there was then gunfire again on the 22nd from right-wing demonstrators. And basically what happened is these 300 or so folks, like, gathered together with a bunch of shields and weapons and paintball guns. And initially, the left-wing demonstrators were the counter-demonstrators were very outnumbered, and there were a lot of really ugly assaults. People, like three and four folks, just beating somebody on the ground. I had my hand broken because I was filming a group of these Proud Boys and other group guys sort of beating people, and broke my hand. And then when I confronted him about it and told him that I was pressing unarmed, he slammed me with his shield two or three times. And there were a lot of really ugly assaults, a lot of mace deployed, a lot of rubber paintballs and frozen paintballs being fired at both press, legal observers, all sorts of folks. And then, Portland has a very active, obviously, left-wing protest community, and people have a good system of kind of bringing folks in during emergencies. So while this fight was going on over a couple of hours, the number of left-wing counter-demonstrators grew and grew until there were way over 1,000 of them. And at that point, both sides clashed in like a full sort of like two shield walls going at each other. And the right-wing demonstrators eventually broke and retreated, largely because they had all brought mace and had been firing mace into the crowd. And when you have enough people shooting mace, it becomes impossible to continue to stand in an area unless you're wearing a high-grade gas mask. And the left-wing protesters all had very good gas masks because they've been getting gassed by the police for 100 or 80-some days prior to this point. And the right-wing demonstrators didn't have gas masks. And so they were eventually, from the sheer mass of mace deployed, unable to stand in the area, and they left. So that's kind of an overview of the 22nd. It was a wild thing to see. And I think kind of within the state government, that helped, that along with the article about what was going on with Patriot Coalition, kind of helped to galvanize will against some of these right-wing demonstrations. There have been some very ugly ones over the last few years, and some really ugly fights between right and left-wing demonstrators, including an assault by members of Patriot Prayer, which is one of our local right-wing groups, on a cider bar that was frequented by anti-fascist activists, where one of them hit a young woman from behind and broke her neck with a baton. So there's been a lot of really ugly fights and kind of minimal. The kind of attitude that the local law enforcement in particular had to these was, these are all mutual combats, right? So we're not going to get involved if two groups of people just decide they want to fight it out in the streets, which is a peculiar thing to hear from law enforcement. And I think after the 22nd, there were just so many injuries and what was happening, because there were no police in sight whatsoever during this gigantic street fight that eventually involved more than 1,000 people. They just didn't intervene. And I think there are now enough voices in city government that are like, you can't just let this happen. This is wild. Like, we can't have 1,000 people beating each other half to death in the street because one group of folks wants to rally with weapons and start hitting people. That's not okay. And I hope that we're past the days where that's going to be allowed to happen.
Our guest is Robert Evans, and he writes for Bellingcat.com. He's based in Portland, Oregon, and this is WMNF in Tampa. You infiltrated this the chat room that was operated by this right-wing group, the Patriot Coalition. You found out that they were planning to infiltrate the left-wing group. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, yeah, you know, it's not wildly difficult to quote-unquote infiltrate. And you'll see a bunch of people. This is always something to be kind of hesitant about. When you hear somebody saying they've infiltrated Antifa, all you have to do is wear a black hoodie and a face mask and stand in the middle of a group of other people doing the same, and you can say, I've infiltrated Antifa. The reality, of course, is that most, like, Antifa or anti-fascism is a collection of tactics that groups of people, many of whom don't know each other and were not previously affiliated, can use. There are some individual anti-fascist groups that are actual organizations. Eugene Antifa would be one. And they're the folks who infiltrated Patriot Coalition and actually handed us those chat logs, which brings me to kind of an important point that I think is often lost in the media. Where when people talk, you know, when the media tends to talk about Antifa or anti-fascists, they all tend to be thinking about these kind of black-clad anarchist kids who mask their faces and break windows and stuff. And that certainly is a chunk of people who engage in those tactics, for sure. But the vast majority of anti-fascist work, and I've communicated with and have contacts in a number of these organizations, the vast majority of what they do is online research, is studying what particularly, like, members of neo-Nazi groups and other racist groups are doing, of infiltrating their organizations, and you know, the kind of information they get out from doing that has proven incredibly useful to state and federal law enforcement in the past. It's cited regularly in charging documents. It's very useful to journalists, and it's again much more. And from my vantage point, from what I've seen, both participating in a huge number of street protests and reporting on the growing insurgent right-wing movement in the United States for years, and sometimes consulting law enforcement for it, is that the vast majority of what quote-unquote Antifa groups do is this sort of research, is this kind of infiltration stuff. You know, I think that there's certainly criticisms to be made about a lot of things that happen in the streets, always. But when it comes to the actual quality of the research a lot of these groups do, it's really, in many cases, kind of beyond reproach. I've seen a lot of very important work done. And, you know, the first really influential piece of writing that I had come out about this right-wing insurgent movement happened after the Christchurch shooting, because I had been studying 8chan for years, this weird little online hole that the Christchurch shooter announced his rampage in. And the question that I kept getting from the media over and over again was, how do we find these guys before they act? What do we do to actually locate these people before they get a chance to kill? And the answer is what a lot of these, what groups like Eugene Antifa do, is you infiltrate these organizations, you read their communications, and you try to identify which members are making explicit threats, which members are, like, traveling to sort of attend events and network with other members, which of them have weaponry, because those are all kind of signs that someone is going to engage in a terrorist attack. There are often clear signs. In fact, the Tree of Life synagogue shooter, an anti-fascist researcher I know, had been receiving death threats from that fellow for months before he carried out his attack. And, you know, prior to Tree of Life, I don't think a lot of that was taken seriously by law enforcement. I know a lot of folks, a lot of researchers and journalists who have gone to law enforcement with death threats, and they get taken more seriously now. But there was prior to Tree of Life, if you had threats that were primarily online, they weren't taken seriously at all. So I think we do owe to these folks who have been doing this online research for years, who have been studying these organizations, we all kind of do owe a debt of gratitude, because when it was not taken seriously by people whose job it is to protect us, these folks knew that this was still a threat and took it seriously and did the documentation. And I do think we have to be grateful for that.
Some of the discussions that that these people on the far right, the Patriot Coalition of Oregon, that you uncovered, some of the discussions are pretty frightening. There's one in which a user named Roger Charlie Bravo posted on September 15th, what we're going to do is not random. Patriots around the country are currently organizing and preparing. We know D-Day is coming after November. What does that mean? How did you interpret that?
I interpret that kind of within the spectrum of a number of things I've heard from different right-wing groups, which is that among members of the far right, the insurgent right, as we call them. So obviously, you know, most people who are conservative, who have right-wing views, are members of a peaceful general society just like the rest of us. But there is a sizable and growing far-right insurgent movement that seeks to do violence against its political enemies. And many of them are convinced that a civil war is coming after the election in November, that either Trump will lose, but it won't be legitimate, or that something, some of them believe that it'll start on the left, certainly, and there's people on the left who think or are worried about a civil war. But on the right, on the far right, the level of preparation for this is pretty extensive. You know, you had, after Jay Danielson, who was the member of Patriot Prayer who was shot to death in Portland, after he was shot by a person who was, you know, affiliated with a BLM protest group and had declared himself Antifa. Stuart Rhodes, the head of the Oath Keepers, which is maybe the largest nationwide militia network in the United States, declared at the start of a civil war. Like, so that you can find, it's not, you don't have to have leaked communications to see people talking about this sort of stuff. Now, does that mean we're going to have a civil war? No, of course not necessarily. But the fact that you do have thousands and thousands of heavily armed people talking about their desire to participate in one should concern us all. It is a serious thing that needs to be dealt with seriously, because that, again, doesn't guarantee that there will be some sort of large civil conflict in the country, but certainly one of the precursors for a large-scale civil conflict is a bunch of heavily armed people who want to do violence to their political enemies. And we do have that. And it's very organized on the far right. You know, from what I'm seeing, it's much smaller on the far left, and also not nearly as well armed, and not nearly as active in actually preparing. Whereas you have a very large insurgent far right movement that's, you know, try to buy ammunition online right now. It's pretty much impossible, and there's a reason for that.
We have people I've talked with. Talked and interviewed people who say, look, Antifa is just like these far-right groups. Both present a danger to our society. You say that the right is more heavily armed than is the left. I don't know if anybody's done a study of it, but the people that I know who are on the left are pretty much nonviolent. And when you hear people equating Antifa with these right-wing groups like the Patriot Coalition or the Oath Keepers or any number, I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. What are your thoughts, having covered both?
I'll say, you know, I reported from the left-wing protests, the BLM protests in Portland for months, you know, most of the first 80 days and or 80 nights of it. And there were no serious injuries. Let's see, for the first, like, 60, 70 days it took for there to be any kind of significant injury caused by a protester. And it was one guy got kicked in the head because he had been driving like erratically. People thought he was trying to like hit them with his car. And there had been a number of successful car attacks. Like it was a horrible thing that was done. And the person who kicked the guy was put in jail. Like it turned himself in and is in jail awaiting sentencing. It took 60 or 70 days for that. And that was not the most serious injury of the protest. All of the most serious injuries were caused by police or federal agents. You know, federal agents shot a young man, Donovan Labella, in the skull with a rubber round because he was holding a boombox over his head. There's video of the whole thing, and it completely shattered his skull. He's been in and out of surgery ever since. So it took, with these quote, issues people have, is that anti-fascist demonstrators embrace force as potentially a valid thing to use in fighting back against fascist violence, as they call it. And usually what that means is property destruction. If you actually look at internal documents, the FBI, that have been leaked from the FBI, that have been leaked from DHS, the vast majority of them will say that when we think about left-wing violence and left-wing, you know, criminal action, it's generally property destruction. And there was not, no one was killed in the streets of Portland until there were multiple weeks of right-wing demonstrations that ended in gunfire first. The night that Jay Danielson was killed was the night of the giant Trump truck rally, which happened the weekend after the giant street fight on the 22nd, and 2 weeks after another right-wing rally where a right-wing demonstrator fired into a crowd with a 9mm handgun, thankfully not hitting people. And on the night he was killed, Jay Danielson and the guy he was with both had mace and batons in their hands, and both had handguns. Jay had like 76 rounds on his body. And the left-wing demonstrator who shot him, it may have been a political killing. It's certainly possible. We do not have, you know, and we will never really have confirmation, because that fellow was killed by deputized, federally deputized police like a week or so later. But early reports from people who were there say that one of the folks on Danielson's side had a knife. Like, I don't know if that guy was scared for his life or what. But kind of the fact of the matter is that these protests in Portland went on for 80-some nights and didn't end in a death until there started being these large and heavily armed right-wing counter-protests. Because, you know, you can say what you will about the BLM demonstrations in Portland. They certainly have broken a ton of laws, but the vast majority of the crimes they've committed have been property crimes. Virtually all of the crimes committed have been, like, damage to police property. People would break the doors of police stations. They would, you know, light trash can fires in front of them and stuff like that. Not things that seriously were injurious to human life. And they weren't really bringing a lot of weapons out, like firearms and stuff. That didn't start to happen until there were these kind of dueling right-wing demonstrations. So when I think about the difference in violence between the two, I think left-wing demonstrators, anti-fascist demonstrators, you know, Antifa, if you want to call them that, are certainly much more comfortable committing crimes. But the vast majority of those crimes tend to be nonviolent crimes, which is why in recent years you've seen more than 300 murders by right-wing extremists, and you've seen arguably one killing that can be connected to somebody who has actually taken part in anti-fascist action. You know, it's just the actual rate of violence against human beings, of deadly violence against human beings. It's not even comparable. You know, again, hundreds and hundreds of deaths due to white supremacist extremists in the United States, and maybe, very arguably, one that you can attribute to an anti-fascist demonstrator.
In these chat logs, did the right-wing Patriot Coalition of Oregon, did it say that the press and lawyers groups like the ACLU were the enemy to be targeted? What did they say about the press and the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild?
Well, one of the members of this group is a convicted felon named David Willis. Willis can't own firearms, but he does own an AR-15-style paintball gun that he loads with rubber rounds and shoots into crowds. And Willis was urging his fellow protesters that the people to target are the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild, because they tend to film these fights, and that thus they're filming, you know, a lot of illegal assaults being committed by right-wing demonstrators. And so they should be harmed. You know, that's what he was talking about. He was talking about essentially going after press. And there was actually even discussion of dressing up in black bloc to appear to be anti-fascist and assaulting press in the street so that it would get blamed on Antifa. There was discussion about both of those things. And there were certainly a lot of assaults on press. David Willis shot at press with his rubber round loaded paintball gun. He hit people that I know.
Our guest is Robert Evans, and he's been investigating right-wing groups on the West Coast, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So, Robert, why Portland? Why has the right targeted your city for these kind of confrontations?
You know, there's a number of reasons, and some of this goes back to Oregon's history. So Oregon has arguably, one of the most, and arguably the most racist history of any state in the Union, because it's the only state in the United States that was founded as a white only state. And in fact, the first Supreme Court justice that Oregon had, a guy named Burnett, had a law that made it illegal for black people to stay in Oregon without getting whipped. And again, this was after the Civil War. White supremacy has a long history here. And Oregon currently has more militia groups per capita than any other state. There is an enormous amount of neo-Nazi activism, not just in Oregon, but in the whole Pacific Northwest. There's an idea among neo-Nazis that came up in the 90s called the Northwest Imperative, which is that because the Pacific Northwest is the whitest part of the United States, everyone who is essentially a Nazi or whatever should move there in preparation for a societal breakdown so that it can become a new whites-only homeland. So Oregon has been dealing with that for a while. The fact that there's a lot more organized Nazis and other kinds of you know, white supremacist extremists within the state. And so there have been clashes between left-wing anti-racist groups and these kind of racist far-right groups for a very long time. I mean, you can go back into the 80s and find examples of that. In fact, you know, Idaho is also kind of a hotbed of this stuff. So Portland has a long history with this, and in fact, Portland's local Antifa organization, Rose City Antifa, is the oldest Antifa organization within the United States. And they formed in the early 2000s because a neo-Nazi music festival was trying to come to Portland. The Hammerskin Nation was trying to do a music festival in Portland, and they successfully shut it down because they thought it would be of significant danger to non-white residents of Portland, which they had reason to believe because there have been murders committed in Portland by members of white supremacist organizations. Kind of the most famous was in the 1990s, a young Ethiopian immigrant named Mulugeta Sarah was murdered by members of the White Aryan Resistance, which is a California-based neo-Nazi organization run by a fellow named Tom Metzger. So all of this is a big part of the background of why Portland has become kind of the center of clashes. Another aspect of it is just that Portland is a very good example of something that is a trend nationwide, which is that cities tend to be more liberal and left-leaning, and rural areas tend to be more conservative and right-leaning. And in Portland, the divide is particularly extreme. Portland and Eugene are two of the furthest left-leaning cities in the entire country. But the Oregon countryside, rural Oregon, is extremely conservative. And so in addition to this history of like actual kind of confrontations between anti-racists and white supremacists, you also have the fact that there's a very real divide between urban and rural in this state. And, you know, rural conservatives have good reason to be frustrated with a lot of the decisions being made by sort of the left-wing majority that lives in the cities, because people who live in Portland and Eugene and, you know, the other cities in Oregon don't really have a conception of kind of the reality of life for people who, you know, work on a farm somewhere in Josephine County. But they get to make the laws for the whole state because of the majority. And, of course, that breeds very reasonable frustration from people. So Oregon is kind of this perfect storm. And because of the way that just media and social media in particular works nowadays, when these clashes started up again in the streets, video from these clashes, riot porn is the term that people use sometimes, started going very viral. And in addition to actual like journalists posting footage from these riots, a kind of a community of, I would call them grifters, set up, who would edit the fight to look worse than they were and to look more one-sided than they were, and would post them up on a number of like far right-leaning sites to try to get people angry. And it sort of, in the years that President Trump has been in office, Portland has developed among the far right into a city where you can go to get into fights and to get experience having street fights, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a right-wing demonstrator. There's a lot going on. Well, so, you ask the question, why Portland? But that's my short answer.
And one thing that really riled up people in the Oregon countryside is that they believe that Antifa was setting the fires that had Oregon on fire a few weeks ago, the wildfires.
Yeah, that led to, because there's no truth to it whatsoever, and that led to one of the oddest moments of this entire summer, which was the FBI, local law enforcement, and local anti-fascist collectives all on Twitter saying the same thing, which was, there's no evidence that this is being done by like left-wing demonstrators, like please stop spreading this around, because it became a real problem. People the level of, and again, I think social media is to blame for this, the level of paranoia that exists in the rural countryside here about left-wing demonstrators, Antifa, is so extreme that, number one, people were carrying out armed checkpoints, people were threatening each other with firearms. It's kind of a miracle no one got killed. I have friends who were prepped that were threatened with an AR-15 by people doing like a street patrol because they were out reporting on the fires. And you also had actual like emergency lines, police emergency lines being flooded, just completely overwhelmed with calls about, you know, someone would see someone in their yard doing something and would assume that it was Antifa and would call, you know, the FBI or whoever about it. And some of what would happen was like people would be trying to create like fire breaks on their own property by doing controlled burns, and people would mistake that for arson. And of course, there's also the fact that this is extremely well documented. You look at Texas's massive wildfires, you look at California's wildfires, or the ones in Oregon, there are always, or what happened in Australia earlier this year, there are always arsonists who come out during these times and will set some fires. And most of them tend to be caught pretty much immediately because they're not well, you know, they're not rationally trying to create a fire for any specific purpose. They're ill people. And this is the thing, again, that happens worldwide when there's massive wildfires, is that people who are arsonists for whatever reason come out and may start some fires. But it doesn't tend to contribute to the actual fire systems that create the problem, because the issues that cause these massive sweeping fires are much more significant than that. You know, it's a matter of climate change. It's a matter of the way the winds are blowing. You know, there's a lot of people who start fires in Southern California, and when the winds are right, nothing happens. But when those Santa Ana winds are blowing in the wrong direction, it can become a problem. You had all of this kind of going on with this massive level of media paranoia about Antifa, and it just caused this horror storm. And it was exacerbated by the fact, I don't know if you've ever been stuck in the middle of a wildfire, but the air in northern Oregon was the worst in the world during that period. And it messed with everybody's head. Everybody was anxious. Everybody was angry all the time. Everybody was short-tempered because you could barely breathe. So you had this kind of perfect intersection of things that always happen during wildfires, of paranoia because of, you know, kind of what the news cycle has taught people to expect. And you had the fact that everyone's miserable because they can't breathe. And it led to a very unpleasant situation.
Robert, I'm almost out of time, but when the president last week during the debate said to the Proud Boys, stand by, and then a few days later on Hannity, he did denounce the far right in this country. But when the president did that, did you notice anything? I mean, of the patriot groups that you've been able to monitor, did they say anything about what the president said during last week's debate?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. One of them, a fellow named Joe Biggs, who's a very prominent Proud Boy, said that, like, when the president said, stand by, Biggs said, this is the president's go-ahead for us to go out and mess people up. Like, we have permission now. That's what he's saying. That's the way they interpreted it. And they immediately, like, within minutes, really, of that statement during the debate, they were selling T-shirts that had the Proud Boys logo and said, stand back and stand by. They were very excited about that. It was the kind of national recognition they had always sought. And so when, I don't know, a few days later, he's on Hannity's show and he disavowed them, it made them very angry. And now, I don't know, you'll find a couple of different responses. There's a chunk of the Proud Boys who seem to be staying with the president and assuming he didn't mean it, and seeing that, like, they still want to be supportive of him because that's the future of their movement. And there's also a chunk of Proud Boys who have gotten much more radicalized and who, you know, the place they all tend to congregate and talk is a chat app called Telegram, which is an encrypted chat app. And in the Telegram conversations that I'm monitoring, a lot of these folks who were very disillusioned by Trump's disavowal are talking about tremendous violence and are talking with group members of Nazi groups, because a lot of explicit Nazi groups, which the Proud Boys are not, are also on Telegram. And I've seen a distinct upswing in the number of memes and videos from Nazis that I've seen shared by Proud Boys and in Proud Boy Telegram chats. So I do think you might be starting to see the Proud Boys kind of split in two directions. The one that wants to be more mainstream and that recognizes they have to kind of hold back in the streets a bit in order to gain the kind of mainstream approval they want. And then the folks who really do just want to do violence and are finding themselves pulled towards more extreme, explicitly Nazi organizations because they want to mess people up, and they see that as their best chance.
Robert Evans, we're out of time, but if people want to read what you've been writing about the far right in Oregon, where can they read it?
You can find me on Bellingcat, which is an open source investigative platform. My colleagues at Bellingcat are the ones who like discovered who shot down MH17 over Ukraine and who poisoned the Skripals in London. So, you know, that's kind of what we do is investigations, and I focus on the far right and kind of the intersection of the internet and these extremist groups.
Robert Evans, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for having me.
That was Robert Evans, who's an investigative reporter for a website called bellingcat.com. And we were talking about his report of a few weeks ago, in which he writes about the Patriot Coalition, finding that he was able to get into their private chat rooms. And he says that the Patriot Coalition was planning violence in Portland, Oregon. Article says Bellingcat has acquired several months of chat logs from the Patriot Coalition of Oregon, a network of pro-Trump, pro-police activists. These chat logs were provided by an infiltrator affiliated with the anti-fascist collective Eugene Antifa. And the among the things that the Patriot Coalition expressed, they expressed a willingness to kill their perceived left-wing enemies. Well, if you want to comment about what you've heard here so far, our phone number is 813-239-9663. That's 813-239-9663. Our email address, if you want to send an email in to us, the address is dj@wmnf.org. Thanks to everybody who made a contribution over the last few days. On Monday and Tuesday, we had a mini fund drive. We raised $62,000, which was really good. And we really appreciate your support. You can always make a contribution on our website, on our secure website. It's WMNF.org. But if you believe in having a radio station like this that covers so many interesting issues in a way that commercial media doesn't cover, we hope that you'll make that contribution so we can stay on the air and stay independent. I'm going to mention a few things before opening up the phone lines. And again, if you want to call in, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Well, as more and more companies announce layoffs and as businesses are shutting down, President Trump seems to be of two minds when it comes to a new stimulus bill. And yesterday he called an abrupt end to negotiations with Democrats over additional COVID relief, delaying talks until after the election, he says, despite ominous warnings from his own Federal Reserve chairman about the deteriorating conditions of the U.S. economy. Trump tweeted that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was not negotiating in good faith and said that he'd ask Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to direct all his focus into confirming his U.S. Supreme Court nominee and not to negotiating with the Democrats. And then, hours later, after he said that, last night, President Trump appeared to change his mind about ending negotiations. He took to Twitter again and called on Congress to send him a standalone bill for stimulus checks, $1,200, a reference to direct payments to most Americans. He also indicated he wants money for businesses that are endangered by the economic crisis. Pelosi has generally rejected taking a piecemeal approach to COVID-19 relief. Vice President Mike Pence and his Democratic challengers, Senator Kamala Harris, are poised to meet for a debate tonight. They're in Salt Lake City, and it is the most highly anticipated vice presidential debate in recent memory. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. At a campaign stop yesterday in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden says America needs to heal its divisions. This is some of what he said in Gettysburg.
There's no more fitting place than here today in Gettysburg to talk about the cost of division, about how much it has cost America in the past, about how much it is costing us now, and about why I believe in this moment we must come together as a nation. As I look across America today, I'm concerned. The country is in a dangerous place. Our trust in each other is ebbing. Hope seems elusive. Too many Americans see our public life not as an arena for mediation of our differences, but rather they see it as an occasion for total, unrelenting partisan warfare.
Joe Biden yesterday in Pennsylvania. The chairman of an Arkansas County Republican committee died from complications associated with COVID-19 yesterday, less than a month after his organization hosted a maskless gathering with other elected leaders. The chairman of the county Republican committee was Steve Farmer, who served as chair of the Craighead County Republican committee in Arkansas. He died yesterday after a weeks-long battle with the coronavirus that resulted in a stay at the ICU and a ventilator. The news comes just 3 weeks after his committee hosted an event with Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas and Representative Louie Gohmert of Texas, who contracted COVID-19 in July for a celebration of Reagan Day. Photos of the event show few attendees wearing masks and few keeping their physical distance. And again, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, I'm wearing my mask and it's just under my chin. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Jessica Green is our phone screener today. And Jessica's taking your calls and letting me know what your name is and what your city is. And we're going to go to the phones right now. We're going to go to John in South Tampa for the first call. Hey, John, you're on MNF. What's up?
Hi, Rob. By golly, where can we get reporting like this? Anywhere in Florida. I mean, it's amazing what you're doing, what the station does. But I just wanted to say real quick, if you're retired like me and you stopped giving, because I had to pull back everything, you know, because I retired and finances are different now. But you know what? I rethought it about a year ago, and now I'm giving $5 a month. I wanted to encourage people. Rob, I used to give more than that, but, you know, I look at that $5 now coming out automatically, and I get a big smile on my face. I get more bang for the buck with that $5. You know, it's like, hey, I'm helping. You know, it's not much. That's all I had to say, brother.
All right, John. Thanks a lot. It is a lot. Thanks. I know on a fixed income, $5 a month is a lot. So thanks, John, for that. 813-239-9663. Our next caller is Nav, and Nav is in Tampa. Hey, Nav, you're on MNF. What's up?
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I want to discuss the issue of white supremacy and my theory. I think you have to look at the white population, and in my opinion, is divided into two groups. The first group is a highly educated professional class that have done very well in the last 40 years. And the second group is an uneducated working class, rural poor, who in the last 40 years have not done very well. And that particular group, I feel, has not been represented by either Republicans or Democrats over the last 40 years. And I think President Trump saw an opportunity. He seized on that group. They embraced him. And they embraced him so much, they put him in the White House. And I think what's going to happen now is a coalition of non-whites and educated professional whites, cosmopolitan whites, they're going to kick Trump out in the elections. Looks like Biden's going to win. And what's going to happen, I think white supremacy and white extremism will get actually worse under Biden, because now this sort of alienated group will have no political leadership once again, and that vacuum will be filled by, you know, these type of extremist groups. And, you know, there's an old saying in politics, mild circumstances, mild politics, extreme circumstances lead to extreme politics. And I think instead of, you know, attacking white supremacy, people that are kind of joining it, we need to get to the root cause and try to resolve why are they feeling so alienated and why do they feel they're so voiceless, and that's allowing these other groups to sort of exploit them.
I think that's a really good point. I don't know how many shows I've done about the decline of the middle class and how if you're at the low end of the scale, whether it's the tax cuts that the president passed or the lack of wage increases over the last 40 years since the beginning of the Reagan administration, that you've been screwed. And we've done probably 200 shows easily on that topic over the last few years. So I agree with you. I think some people are left behind. I would take a little bit of issue. I don't think it's just simply the white working class. I think there's middle class people. I drive through some of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Tampa where there are million-dollar homes. And I always drive through those neighborhoods and I count the Biden and the Trump signs. And I think it's fair to say that there's more Biden signs than there are Trump signs, but in front of million-dollar homes, I see Trump signs. So I don't think it's that. But I do think you're right. I think whoever is elected president, whether it's Trump, and I'm not so sure that you're right that Biden's going to win, but whoever's elected president, I think they've got to say, look, the people at the top have made money for 40 years. And the difference between the top and the bottom has increased. So there's now more businesses closing. More people are in danger of losing their homes or being kicked out of their rental apartments. That wages have not kept up with productivity. So I think the next president has to say that and has to say, okay, we've given a lot of gifts to the people at the top. What we need to do now is concentrate on those low and moderate income people, you know, who can't afford college. Let's make college more affordable. Let's make healthcare more affordable. Let's make wages better because productivity has shot up while wages have really remained flat since the early 1980s. Next president has to do that. I don't know if it's going to be Trump or Biden, but I agree with you on that point. Okay.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nav. Let's go to Mike, who's in South Tampa. Mike, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Good morning. Yes, I'm an avid researcher. Of course, I used to watch Johnny Carson's show called Who Do You Trust? Now, when it comes to coronavirus testing, I've checked with three different diagnostic lab techs, and they've all told me the same thing.
Mike, we played your comment about this a few weeks ago. You're making the claim that the coronavirus is not really that dangerous or widespread, and you've made it a couple of times as you called in. And every time you call in, I think, wow, that guy is. Forgive me for saying this because I'm sure you're a great guy, but you're way off base. So why do you think? Let's just cut to the chase. Why do you think there's not that many cases of coronavirus and it's not that deadly?
Okay, first of all,
You've called many times before, and I know your voice, so let's be real with each other, okay?
Sure. The lab techs tell me that the coronavirus antibodies test is not a confirmation for infection. It's merely a confirmation that you have antibodies.
Yeah, well, that's true, but most people are getting the coronavirus test. So a lot of, you know, you've got a lot of people have tested positive for coronavirus. You've made the claim before that there's not that many cases out there. It's not that serious. Why do you think it's not that serious?
Yeah, again, because it's an automatic news. Oh, a person tested positive.
No, but not everybody's getting tested for antibodies. Some people are being tested for coronavirus. I think you're conflating the two and you're mixing it up. So why do you think it's not that dangerous?
About coronavirus antibodies testing.
All right. Well, we're not talking about antibodies testing. We're talking about coronavirus testing. You're trying to say that everybody's getting an antibodies test. No, not everybody's getting an antibodies test. Let's go to Remy in Lakeland. Remy, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Thank you for doing an awesome job on your show, as always. Just a random comment or suggestion. I feel that whoever gets elected for the president in this year, 2020, at some point is inevitably going to have to really raise taxes to cover for all the spending that's been done this year with the bailouts and the stimulus plans. And I think it's important that if anyone has a Roth IRA, to really try to double down on how much you're putting into it, because it's going to be crazy times ahead. And, you know, with the Roth IRA, the government can't tax it if you pull it out at the right time. So I know there's a limit per year. But anyone that has a Roth IRA, I highly suggest you go ahead and start putting in as much as you can.
All right, Remy, thanks a lot. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, and we'll be talking about the debate tonight. Thanks to Jessica Green, our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Lakeland, and Sarasota. Here's the latest news.